Okay, tonight we are picking up in the book of Ruth, and we are going to start in Ruth chapter 2. Normally when I work through a section, of course I spend several hours throughout the week doing my exegetical analysis, but when I get into the text and I'm working through it, it's hard for me not to be moved by the text itself as I read these historical narratives, these accounts. I'm not one really to title a message. I just tend, read through the passage. But if I were going to title this message, I would title it "Surprised by Grace," because that's what I see here in the life of Ruth. Her response is that she is overwhelmed, that she's surprised, as it were, by the kindness and the favor that is shown to her. And to be honest, several times as I was reading through this, it brought me to tears because I began to think about the Lord Jesus Christ and the kindness and the mercy and the favor that He has extended to me. And I think we'll see here in this context Boaz as a model of Christ and the goodness that He displays. So, anyway, let's get into our text, and we'll start in Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. And it begins to read, "Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech." Now Elimelech was her husband, if you remember, back in Ruth chapter 1, verse 3. That's the name of Naomi's husband who had died, remember, after they went into the land of Moab. But anyway, there was this kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. There's some question about the meaning of the name Boaz. The best I was able to come up with is that the name means quickness. Now, later on, Boaz is going to be described as a valiant man, a warrior, as it were. And it could be that his name is indicative of his skill as a warrior. It's hard to read into that sometimes, but it does make you think. So verse 2, "And Ruth, the Moabitess." And again, we talked about this last time, that throughout the book of Ruth, her Gentileness is repeated over and over. And so we see in Ruth chapter 1, verse 22. We see it here in Ruth 2:2, and then again in verse 6, verse 21. And then in chapter 4, verse 5, and chapter 4, verse 10, that we have these references over and over and over again, that she's not just Ruth, she's Ruth the Moabitess. And this is significant because as a Moabitess, she is outside of the covenant community, that she was not part of the original covenant community with which God had initiated with Israel. But I think what we're going to see is that because she committed herself to God, that she is going to be brought into the covenant community. And we're going to see this as it unfolds throughout this chapter. So again in verse 2, "And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain.'" Now, first of all, we should... I read several commentaries, and one commentary raised the question, why didn't Naomi go herself? And it could be that she's older, that she lacks the physical ability to do it. It could be that she's depressed. Remember, her son, her husband has died. Her two sons have died. She's come back into the land. And Naomi, we saw before, that she didn't want to be called by that name. What did she want to be called by? Mara, which means bitter. And so this is a reflection of her personality, of her mindset at this time. But what we have here is, if you remember back in Ruth chapter 1, and looking at verse 16 and 17, what we see is Ruth's commitment to her mother-in-law. It's really her statement of faith is what it is. And remember that Naomi had told her daughters-in-law to go back several times, and But Ruth says in verse 16, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge, and your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse if anything but death parts you from me." Now that's a very profound statement. It's not only a statement of faith, it's a statement of commitment that she's now going to care for Naomi. So I think we see this as borne out verse 2 when she says, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain." They didn't have a welfare system like we do today where one can make application and receive resources. What they did was they had a system that cared for the poor that allowed people to go and be able to get the food that will sustain them from day to day. And let's look at a few passages related to that. Go with me back to Leviticus chapter 19. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Third book in the Pentateuch. And we'll look at a few verses related to this privilege that was given to the poor. And in Luke chapter 19, excuse me, not Luke, Leviticus, yeah, Leviticus 19, and we'll look at verses 9 and 10. And in Leviticus 19:9, it says, "Now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God." And so God is here commanding the Israelites who have control over the fields, who own the fields, to not reap the corners of the fields. And if something falls to the ground, they're to leave it for the poor to come in and to harvest it for themselves so that they can eat. It was a means of caring for them. Also in Leviticus chapter 23, verse 22, it says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, moreover, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleaning of your harvest. You are to leave them for the needy and the alien." Again, the stranger, the visitor is passing through. And again, God says, "I am the Lord your God." It's like God is affixing his signature, as it were, to this personal command, because God is concerned about the widows. He's concerned about the orphans. He's concerned about the poor. He's concerned about the needy within the community. And so what God is here commanding will benefit those who are, in effect, impoverished. But one other verse, Deuteronomy 24. Go with me over a few chapters on this one. Deuteronomy 24, verse 19. Do I? Okay. Verse 19. It says, When you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. Now catch the last clause here. In order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So this command comes with a blessing that for the person who reaps the land, if they leave these portions for the widows, for the orphan, for the alien, for the impoverished, that by following this command, it actually comes with a blessing by the Lord himself. And I find that to be pretty interesting, because a lot of people would think of the blessing as reaping all of it. Okay, but God says, no, you're not to reap all of it. You're to leave some for the poor. And so it was a very mindful act with regard to the less fortunate within the community. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking it reminds me of common grace.
Okay,
you know, it reminds me of, even though he has in provisions, the Lord just providing in general for his creation, all of his creation.
Yes, and you know what she means by common grace, right? Matthew chapter 5. We could really pick up in verse 43. It says, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." And verse 45 is the verse that's commonly set forth that demonstrates common grace. "So that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven." And then here Jesus uses the Father as his example. "For he causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." And so that is God's common grace that he extends to all of humanity. Evil, good, righteous, unrighteous, everybody gets the sun, everybody gets the rain. It's the blessing that God gives. What's interesting about this passage, though, is that God's blessing here is commanded to come through people. It's commanded to come through those persons who are in charge of the fields. And so in that sense, they are to reflect the grace that God has bestowed upon them. And so it becomes a reflection of their understanding of their relationship to God. So it's blessing through people. And that's sometimes the question we have to ask. Is God going to use me to bless this person? Yes, ma'am.
And for sure. And I was just thinking about how, like his provision, how some people believe, oh, God just created and then left it, walked away from it.
Yeah.
It's like everything that he's created, you know, he tends to it and meets those needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you see as far as the chosen, he's taking care of them through this and having the vineyards and having, you know, the fields in general to pull from what they need, but at the same time, he hasn't forgotten the needy and the poor and the orphan.
Right.
You know, he still meets their needs as well.
It's
just like it always reminds me of this picture in my head of like wedding cup tears.
Mm-hmm.
You know how they pour the champagne over the very first one.
Yeah, and then it spills into the second.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah.
So, you know, God being the first one and who he is spilling out, it blesses all those underneath him.
Yeah.
You know?
What's sad is that some people stop that process because of selfishness, because of greediness. They withhold that which God intends for the poor, for those who are further down on the chain. And that's what Francis Schaeffer's audio lesson is about. It's a wonderful message, and it's the one titled Ash Heap Lives. But he speaks very strongly to that issue, and quite passionately, I might add. So again, going back here to the text of Ruth chapter 2, "And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain." So what she's doing here is she's wanting to work within the system. She's not going to steal. She's going to work within the system as it is. And then she says, "After one in whose sight I may find favor." So she's hoping to go out and find favor among one of the landowners.
Basically allowing her to do
this. Allowing her to do this. But the word favor, I've underscored it here because we're going to see it three times in this passage we're reading through. Because she's going to hope to find favor. She's going to find it. She has no idea the abundance of grace that is coming upon her. She has no idea. And I think even in her own life, I don't think she had any idea that she would even be in the line of Messiah. She had no idea the grace that was going to come upon her. But she's going out with the hope that she might find it. And it translates the Hebrew word ken, C-H-E-N. Some might say chen. A little more guttural pronunciation there. And the word is commonly used to translate it as favor or grace. And so she's going out in the hopes that she may find favor. And she said to her, that is, Naomi said to Ruth, "Go, my daughter." And the term daughter here is a very intimate term. It's a very affectionate term. It speaks of a closeness. And this is going to be important in the middle of this chapter and at the end of this chapter. So we'll see this word again. So it's one of those things where as you're reading through a passage, you always want to pick up on the repetition of words or phrases that appear. But it's a term of tenderness here. Verse 3, so she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to a portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech.
Providence.
Exactly.
Providence.
Right. Nothing just happens. Okay, so when the text says that she happened to come to this portion of the field belonging to Boaz, it is God's unseen guiding hand. And that's what providence is. It is God's working out the details of His sovereign plan. Sovereignty is His divine right of authority to rule over His creation, His creatures, as He sees fit. Providence is His working behind the scenes, and sometimes openly, to bring about that which He has planned. So Ruth comes in, and she goes out, and she has no idea the direction she's heading. She has no idea that God is guiding her providentially to this field to meet this man. And so, again, she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now, again, the author gives us something there that this shows that Boaz belongs to the family of Elimelech, to which Ruth finds herself. So verse 4, now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, and I love what he says. He says, may the Lord be with you. Now that is first of all an expression of faith, because he's recognizing the Lord in his speech and in his circumstances. Not only that, it's an expression of consideration of the less fortunate. When he says, may the Lord be with you. So it's in effect, he's thinking about them from the divine viewpoint. And he genuinely cares about their needs. And notice how they respond to him. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. Now that's a very interesting statement coming from the workers of the field. It tells me that they have a very good relationship. That they think very highly of him. And they realize that their blessing is connected to his blessing. So it's that blessing by association principle, whereby they look at Boaz and they say, oh, you want the Lord's best for us? That's wonderful. May the Lord bless you, because in your blessing, we have blessing. And this is a principle, I think, that is borne out throughout the Scripture. In fact, God promises even Abraham that those who bless you, I will bless. And those who came into relationship with Abraham and treated him well were ultimately blessed by God. There's another passage, if you remember over in Jeremiah, and I was thinking about it the other day, but Jeremiah chapter 29, we have the context here where God, remember, he destroyed the southern kingdom of Judah in 586 B.C., and he was going to send them into captivity where? In Babylon, under Nebuchadnezzar. And so this is, in effect, their guidance, their instruction for how they are to behave while in captivity. And by the way, when you read through the book of Daniel, Daniel is a model of how to behave as a captive in a foreign land. And in effect, a model, I think, for believers in general. But think about this verse here in verse 7, where God is telling the captives. He says, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. Now, this is a pagan city. They're going to have a position of dominance, of authority over them. And yet God tells his people, the Israelites, he says, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will have welfare. Do you see that? So again, it's that blessing by association. And I think we see that also here among Boaz and the reapers. Because he says, may the Lord be with you, and they reply back, may the Lord bless you. So again, this here is an expression on the part of the reapers, an expression of faith in which they desire God's blessing to Boaz, who I classify here as the merciful wealthy. Because we have a lot of wealthy people in the world, but not everybody demonstrates mercy or compassion towards the poor. Verse 5, then Boaz said to his servant, who was in charge of the reapers, this would be his foreman as it were, whose young woman is this? So he takes note of Ruth. He sees that she's different. Now, why does he take note of her? Well, it could be that she's a foreigner. It could just be that she has a different face. He's not seen her before. It could be that he finds her attractive. Whatever the reason, he asks, whose young woman is this? Verse 6, and the servant in charge of the reapers replied, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. So he's going to give this report about Ruth. And it goes on, and she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Now what's interesting here is when she comes, she asks permission to glean and to gather among the reapers of the sheaves, even though it is her right to do so under the law, she doesn't demand her right. She comes and seeks permission to do this thing. So I think that that says something about her character, that she comes and she asks for permission rather than effect assuming or demanding her rights.
Why is it her? I don't understand. How is it her right for?
Because of the passages we read in Leviticus 19, 23, and 24, where God commanded the owners of the fields to leave the corners and to allow the gleanings for the widows, the orphans, the alien, of which Ruth would be among that class.
Like if you read further in Leviticus, or maybe it was Deuteronomy, where he said, after you glean, don't go back over your field again to get what's left over.
Right, leave it.
If you pick olives, you know, don't pick up the ones that are dropped.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So she knew, and I think culturally here, not that she was necessarily a Levitical scholar, you know, or a Deuteronomic scholar, but, you know, rather than coming and demanding it, she comes and she asks permission. And, you know, that's one thing about good manners. I remember reading a book some years ago, and there was a comment made in there that good manners are the lubricant of society. And I think that's a true statement, that when people have very good manners, a thoughtfulness and a consideration of others and how that they approach them, it just makes the social gears of relationship turn so much more easily. So again, yes, ma'am, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And as you were reading that, and then you think about, because like you said about her right, you know, to me, she's not acting entitled.
Right. Entitled. Very important. Not a sense of entitlement. Yeah.
You know,
she knows.
She's being very humble.
Yes.
You know, and she's, whenever you read that, it made me think about the 1 Peter 3:4, how says, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of gentle and quiet spirit, which
there
is precious in the sight of God.
Absolutely. Beautiful verse to bring up.
You know, and I
love your theological mind, yes. Very good.
But I thought it's precious in the sight of God. That's pleasing to God.
Yes. You know, a gentle and quiet spirit.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she comes with that. So she's not loud and demanding. She comes and she asks for permission. So, again, Boaz is getting this report that she is the woman, she's the young Moabite who returned with Naomi. She comes and she asks permission to glean. Going on in verse 7, thus she came and has remained from morning until now. And she has been sitting in the house for a little while. In other words, the report that he gives is that she's working hard and she's only taking short breaks.
Yeah, in the home it says, she came and has remained from early morning until now, except that she rested a little while in the shelter.
Yeah. So she demonstrates herself to be a woman with a very hard work ethic, too. That she's not a slacker by any means. She shows up and she has a mind to work. And she takes very short breaks. Now again, Boaz is getting this. He's hearing this firsthand report from his foreman, as it were, the man who was in charge of the reapers. Verse 8, now we're going to have Boaz addressing Ruth directly. And Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully. And notice he calls her my daughter. Same term. Again, a term of affection, a term of tenderness. But it could also be that by calling Ruth his daughter, that it's showing the age gap between Boaz and Ruth. Because Boaz, I think, is older. He's probably closer to Naomi's age. And this term could be some subtle suggestion here to differentiate their age here.
How old do you think Boaz is, where he age-wise?
He could be 40s, 50s. I think Ruth is young. I think maybe early 20s, I'm guessing. I can't
21?
Say for sure. What?
Maybe 21?
Maybe, yeah, just the legal age, that's right. So he calls, he says, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids." So by inviting her to stay with the maids, he's really inviting her to move from the boundaries into the hired community, which she goes then from being just a passerby to somebody who's part of his basic work group. Stay here with my maids. Verse 9, "Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. And when you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Well, this is quite amazing here, because that was really not permitted. It's a step up here. Right. So he's, in effect, offering Ruth not only protection, but he's also offering provision beyond what the law requires. The law only requires him to leave the corners of the fields and to leave that which has fallen onto the ground for them to come and to glean. And so he's offering her really more than what the law really commanded him to offer. Verse 10, and notice her response. "Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, 'Why have I found,'" and there's our word again, "'favor in your sight, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner.'" And in this context, in this verse 10, what we have is Ruth surprised by grace. She doesn't expect it. In fact, she probably expected to be ill-treated, because that's the way a lot of people are in society. And remember, this is during the period of the judges. There was probably a great deal of abuse going on here.
At least mocked or made fun of.
Right. And so here Boaz stands out as a shining light, as it were, in the midst of all this darkness. And she sees that, and she says, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" Verse 11, "Boaz replied to her, 'All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know.'" And so what he's taken by is her demonstration of unselfish love to sacrifice her land, her heritage, her family, everything, and to go completely to this foreign land, a foreign place, foreign people, in order to care for Naomi. And Boaz sees this, he hears about this, and he's really taken by her. He's taken by her humility. He's taken by her kindness, by her commitment to Naomi. Verse 12, he goes on. He says, "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Now, this is in effect a prayer that Boaz offers when he says, "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full." What's interesting is Boaz is going to be the one who fulfills the very prayer that he utters. Because it's one thing that Boaz offers this, in effect, this petition for her. But God is going to use Boaz to do that very thing. And so, again, I point here in the bracketed section here that the Lord would fulfill Boaz's request through Boaz himself. And notice this is one of those passages. We find it also in the Psalms where he uses the illustration where he says, "The God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." It's a picture of intimacy. It's what's referred to in theology as a zoomorphism, We have these this language in Scripture which is called language of condescension, in which God comes down and He explains Himself to us in terms that we understand, or language of accommodation, kind of like we come down to a child to explain things on their level. Well, there's what's called anthropomorphisms, where certain attributes are attributed to God, like a hand, an eye, an arm, that sort of thing. Or not just anthropomorphisms, but what's the other term? Yeah, we have anthropomorphisms and anthropopathisms. That's it. I couldn't think of it. A pathism. Yeah, an anthropopathism. Pathos, from the word meaning emotion. So we talk about God being angry, or God being happy or something. It's a term that's employed of God to help us understand. Well, this is what's referred to as a zoomorphism. God isn't a big bird. He doesn't have wings or feathers. But it's a picture that helps us to understand something about God. By the way, this is used of the Lord Jesus Christ Himself, now that I think about it, over in Matthew chapter 23. Oh, you beat me to it. Oh, no, it's actually Matthew 23, verse 37. In Matthew 23, 37, it says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling." And so again, it's a picture of caring, of comfort. Can you imagine how safe those little chickies feel when they're under the mama's wings, right?
I just shared that verse with someone.
Did you? Okay. That's great. So moving on, verse 13 of our passage. Then she said, "I have found favor," and there's that word again, "I have found favor in your sight, my Lord," and she calls him here Lord, Adon, or Adonai. We think of the term Adonai, commonly used of God, but it's also used of people. And then she said, "I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." And so she expresses her gratitude that Boaz is exceptionally kind to her. Well, it gets even better. Verse 14, "At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar.'" So he's making Ruth feel comfortable in his personal presence. He's inviting her into his very personal presence to eat and to drink with him. Going on, "So she sat beside the reapers," and catch this, "he served her roasted grain." Now this is really turning it around, isn't it? Because who's serving who? Boaz is serving her. And what is he serving her? A delicacy. A roasted
love.
Grain, huh?
Love.
Love, yeah. Don't you know, her heart is just warming.
She ate and was satisfied.
She was ate and was satisfied. Yes. That's right.
Yes.
That's right. It goes on. It says, so he sat beside her and he served her roasted grain.
Read between the lines here.
Yeah. 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 And she ate and was satisfied and had some left. Now, what we're going to see later on is she's going to pocket some of this and take it back to Naomi. But she's again, feeling very satisfied as a result of not only him as a person, but with regard to the food, the provision that he's giving to her. Verse 15, "When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her.'" Oh my, isn't that interesting? "So let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean." In other words, there's to take some of their own harvesting and pull it out, in effect, lay it on the ground and make it easy for her to come along and pick up the labor of others. Grace, way beyond anything she hoped for. And again, she started off with this request to Naomi that I may go and find favor. She has no idea. So again, this is playing out. So again, Boaz here is providing more than what the law prescribes. And he says, "And do not rebuke her," that is, do not make her feel rejected.
I think Boaz is hard to jump at this time too.
It could very well be. It could very well be. He's trying to woo her over.
Yeah.
It could be. Well, he's we know how the story ends. So he's eventually going to marry her. He's going to buy the land. He's going to do what he has to do to obtain her as a wife. It seems to be. Verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening. So again, it's a sunrise to sunset. She has worked all day long. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. What are we talking about here? We're talking about roughly 30 pounds of barley. Yeah, a lot. Normally, they were lucky to get enough for a meal or two. What she has here is about 2 weeks worth of food, or we might consider it half a month's wage. So she goes hoping to get a few little grains here and there, and she walks away with, in effect, a 2 week paycheck. For 1 day's work.
Awesome.
Yeah. Not only that, but she must have been pretty physically strong.
Yeah.
Not only to labor that intensively for the day, but she's going to have to lug this.
And beat it out.
Yeah, right. And then lug it. And then bring it back to the city. So
she's a tough cookie,
we might say. Yeah. Absolutely. So verse 18, she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. I'm sure she was surprised. What do you think?
Where'd you steal that?
So she also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left over after she was satisfied. In other words, some of the roasted grain. And her mother-in-law then said to her, "Where did you glean today and where did you work?" She's probably thinking, you know, because this is an unusual amount that she's brought home. And then she offers a blessing. She says, "May he who took notice of you be blessed." So she realizes here that Ruth has received special treatment. Naomi's pretty sharp. She's been around enough. She knows what's going on. And she looks at what Ruth brings home, and she's thinking, "You've been shown some special treatment here." Okay? Continuing on. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz." Now that probably caused something to spark in Naomi because she knows who Boaz is. So verse 20, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he, that is Boaz, be blessed of the Lord who has not withheld his kindness to the living and the dead." And the word kindness there is that wonderful Hebrew word we've considered before, chesed. And it's the word that means loyal love or commitment love. And so she is, and by the way, she says, "May he be blessed of the Lord." Now, this from the woman who felt that God had turned his hand against her. Remember that? Now she realizes that God's hand, she's now speaking favorably of the Lord. And she's speaking favorably of the Lord because of how Boaz has treated Ruth. So again, may he be blessed of the Lord who has not withheld, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living, that would be to Ruth and Naomi, and to the dead, that would be, I believe, to Elimelech and his two sons. So by treating the living this way, he's also honoring the men who died. By caring for their widows, and we worry about the people we love, and we think about the people we love, and we think, what happens to me, and how nice it would be to know that if we died, that somebody else stepped up and was willing to care for the person for whom we cared. And so I think in this regard, I think Boaz is showing honor to Elimelech and his two sons by caring for Naomi and Ruth. Yes, ma'am.
That not withdrawn his kindness to the living, to the dead. That reminds me of Jesus on the cross with Mary and John.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know?
Yes, good analogy. Because you're right. When the Lord was upon the cross, he looks at John and he says, "Behold, thy mother." Well, mm-hmm. Mary was not his mother,
right.
But in effect, he's telling him, care for her,
right.
Treat her like your own mother. And so, in effect, even on the cross, he's concerned about the life of Mary and what's going to happen to her now that Jesus is gone. Absolutely. So, you know, regarding having care for those people who need help, I think is very much a theme that runs all the way through the Bible, from beginning to end. And it's a demonstration of God's mercy, of God's grace, of God's kindness to the less fortunate. And I think it also speaks to how we should regard those who are less fortunate in the community, that we should, in effect, be open-handed and giving to help the poor in our communities. So anyway, he goes on here in the rest of the verse. And again, Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is one of our..." And then we have a clause here. "He is one of our closest relatives." And this translates the Hebrew word Gaal, or sometimes we hear it as Goel. And this refers to what is called a kinsman redeemer. Now, a kinsman redeemer, or a Goel, was somebody who in the family community, it could be a father, an uncle, a cousin, a grandfather, could be anybody within the family community who was wealthy enough, who had the resources to redeem somebody who had fallen on difficult times. For example, if a man became so poor, and this is, by the way, this is the way that slavery was in the Old Testament. There's no comparison with it today. But in the Old Testament, a person could sell himself, according to the book of Exodus, a person could sell himself into servitude for 7 years. Right? And what he was doing was he was working to pay off a debt. That's the kind of servanthood or slavery that existed in the Bible. It was not like what we see today, where people are kidnapped and forced into servitude, which is absolutely non-biblical, very corrupt. But a redeemer could come and could pay this man's debt and thus liberate him from slavery. It was also true of men who died, and their widows did not have the resources to care for the land. Well, a redeemer could come along and pay that redemption price and thus wind up becoming the caregiver of that relative who had died and his family who was still living. So this term, a closest relative or a kinsman redeemer, refers again to somebody who is a family guardian who cares for the widows of his deceased relatives. Now go with me to a few passages. Go with me back to Deuteronomy chapter 25. And let's read about it. Deuteronomy chapter 25. And again, it was optional. And there was even a pecking order. When we get to Ruth chapter 4, we're going to see where Boaz, even though he has the resources, he's not first in line to assume this role. It's actually another family member. But he has to go to that family member and say, "Will you exercise this right under the law and redeem, buy the land and redeem or take to yourself Naomi and Ruth?" And he says, no. And under the law, he wasn't obligated to do it. It was something that he could do, but he didn't have to do. But Boaz tells him, if you're not going to do it, if you decline, and we'll make this a public legal transaction here, then I will take that right upon myself because it felt...
As that was passed on that way?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember reading that, yes.
Yeah. So in Deuteronomy chapter 25, and we'll look at verses 5 through 10, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. And by the way, this was to keep property within the family. It was to keep not only property, but valuables and resources within the family. Shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as a wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And this is what's referred to as a levirate vow, from the Latin levir, which means like brother-in-law, if I remember correctly. Verse 6, "It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say," and this is what we're going to see actually occur in Ruth chapter 4, "but if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses, well, it doesn't go this far, but she says, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in the land, in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. So in effect, she's going to shame him. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. Well, that's pretty strong. And she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. And there's some question about the taking off of the sandal, because we're going to see that mentioned in Ruth chapter 4. And the idea of removing the sandal is that you're forfeiting the right to tread on the ground that you're asked to redeem. We'll look more at that later, but there's some question about that. So anyway, there was this this recognition by Naomi to Ruth that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. So he not only has the right, the legal right under the law, to make their life a lot better, but he also has the resources. Picking up in verse 21, then Ruth the Moabitess said, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you not go out with. It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, so that others do not fall upon you in another field. And the idea is that by staying close to Boaz, she's not going to be subject to others who would seek to harm her. Because you could see how in some societies, somebody who's traveling like that, a foreigner who's all alone, who has nobody to protect her, how someone like that could easily be abused. I think we see some of that in every age, in every culture. I was watching a show just the other night, was catching the tail end of it, about trafficking that's going on around the world. And we're seeing more and more of it here in the States. And that, you want to talk about a modern form of slavery. I mean, really, that's it.
Earlier, you may not have legal slavery.
Right. Yeah, there's other forms, yeah.
Yes.
So verse 23, so she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. So basically, she was given permission to stay in Boaz's field for several months. And this would be probably April through June would be the time frame. So this last verse here tells us, it gives us a little bit of a time frame, that Ruth goes day after day, week after week, for several months throughout the barley and the wheat harvest. And it says in the last clause there, and she lived with her mother-in-law. And the idea is that she continued to care for her. So she had the resources to keep coming back day after day and to keep providing food for her mother-in-law, Naomi. But again, it gives us a little bit of a time frame as far as it going on for several months and what time of the year the harvest was taking place.
Now, this land that Boaz has, that where all the land is being harvested, that's not his land?
No, it's his land.
It's his land.
Okay. What he's going to agree to buy later on in the book of Ruth is he's going to agree to buy the land of Elimelech, Naomi's departed husband.
Right.
So
who
does he pay? Does he pay Naomi for that?
Yes. Yes,
he pays Naomi for that?
Yeah, he buys the land and it falls to the one, because she has no means to work the land.
Right.
She has no way to work it herself. It's just land that's sitting there. Or it could have been temporarily sold to another person. Because under the Mosaic law,
so land, nobody's doing anything on that land right now.
Right.
On Naomi's land.
Right. Or if they are, it's under contract, because what they could do is they could, quote, buy land. But if you remember, every 49th year.
Oh.
The land by law had to fall back to the original owner, because when God gave the land to somebody,
right.
If they, quote, sold it, it was really a contract.
Because he gave certain land to certain tribes.
Right.
And it was supposed to remain
that way. It was supposed to remain that way. They could never forfeit that land.
Mm-hmm. So wasn't there
Right.
Pretty much.
Now, if they fell on hard times, what they could do is they could sell it to somebody who had the money, and then that person could work the land until the year of Jubilee, which was every 50th year. And at the end, and so it was 49 years that they could work the land. And then in the year of Jubilee, which was the 50th year, the land fell back to the original rightful owner. And so it could be that the land, and we don't know, but the land could be being used by somebody else, or it could just be lying there. But either way, Naomi has no resources. She has no way to work the land and nobody to help her. And so the fields that she's working in is going to be Boaz fields. So, but he's obviously a very wealthy man. As a matter of fact, the opening verse tells us that. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth. It's literally Ish Gibor is what the Hebrew says. And Ish Gibor is literally a mighty man. The same term is used of some of the judges. But I think it has the idea, the connotation here of a mighty man with regard to having great wealth. Because he's obviously going to pay the redemption price. He has the resources to do that. But again, when we think about the way that Ruth is treated here in this chapter, she's treated quite graciously. I mean, she's really shown favor that's really above and beyond, again, what the law requires. And this comes out of the goodness of Boaz, demonstrating what kind of man he is. So. All right, well, let's take a break, and we'll come back and hit the summary points, because there's some good stuff in there, too.